Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Ask Dr. Dawn. Regular listeners will have heard me describe the microbiome in some detail, but every day we seem to learn more and more, and the amount of research being done on the microbiome is just astonishing. Briefly, there is a complex dialogue taking place at all times between the bacteria living in our intestines, which number, well, at least in terms of cells, at least 100 times more cells inside us than of us. The bacterial to human ratio is variously thought of as 100 to 1,000 to 1. Furthermore, many of these bacteria that live inside our intestines actually serve important biological purposes, purposes without which we could not survive. You can have germ-free mice, but germ-free humans cannot exist. As you'll learn in a moment, our interview guest believes that the bacteria directly influence our epigenetic settings, like DNA methylation as well. She is a member of the Dirt is Good school of gastroenterology, and as such, is a homegrown functional gastroenterologist. I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Dr. Robin Chutkan and talk about her new book, The Microbiome Solution, a radical new way to heal your body from the inside out. Hello, Dr. Chutkan. This is Dr. Dawn Motika. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to speak with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Chutkan is a gastroenterologist on faculty at Georgetown University Hospital, and she's written a couple of books about the microbiome. Her latest, The Microbiome Solution, gave us the opportunity to speak with her. Dr. Chutkan, my audience is already very familiar with the basic concepts of the microbiome. It's been a topic of dialogue on my program for quite some time. But there were some intriguing things that I picked out of your book that I'd like to ask you to speak on.
Wonderful.
The first of these was just the idea that there are instructions missing from our genome that are supplied by these symbiotic bacteria in our gut. Could you elaborate on that statement? Because that was a new one to me.
Absolutely. So this whole concept of epigenetics, basically how our environment, our microbes, and our genes all interact, is really fascinating. And I think one of the studies that really highlights that was a Harvard study from a few years ago where they took 9 volunteers and they put them on a sort of Atkins-type high-protein, high-fat diet for about a week, and they looked at the microbiome before, during, and after, and then they rested them for 5 days, and they put them on a plant-based diet of jasmine rice and lentils and fruit and so on. What was fascinating was not only did the microbes change, we'd sort of expect that the microbes would change, and they change within about 30 hours of the food hitting the gut. But what was really fascinating was that the genes that were turned on and off also changed, and they changed quite dramatically, because I think we think about microbes as being more static. We don't think that they, we think about our genes as being more static. We don't think that they change. But this modulation of genes by bacteria, in fact, explains in large part why inherited diseases don't always afflict family members equally, even in identical twins who have the same genes. So, you know, when you think about just the number, we have about 23,000 human genes, and we have over 8 million microbial ones. So there's a lot of kind of switching on and off and complementary synthesis that goes on that allows genes to work that really rests on our microbiome.
I see. As I recall in that study, one of the volunteers was a vegan, and the others were eating a more mixed diet. The vegan had some interesting phenomenon. Would you care to speak to that?
Absolutely. So you know, you can, and I see this in my practice, you can be an unhealthy vegan. There's such a thing in the way you interpret it. And you can be a vegan who's eating Pop-Tarts and cereal mostly and not eating a lot of plants. And you can be an omnivore who's eating a lot of plants. So, you know, unfortunately, the title itself, you would think that veganism means you're eating a lot of plants, but not necessarily the way it's interpreted in our society. So if we say somebody who's plant-based, which might be more accurate, somebody who's eating primarily plants, we do see much lower rates of colon cancer and various diseases in people who eat a plant-based diet. And we know that switching to a plant-based diet can have profound effects on the microbiome. It's something that we've used in our practice with great success in some of our patients with more severe autoimmune disease, particularly Crohn's and colitis. And, you know, I remind patients that it's less about taking out the sugar and the gluten and the fat and so on, and it's more about making sure they're eating enough plants. So when we first started using a lot of nutritional therapy for our patients, we generally used a diet called a specific carbohydrate diet, SCD, which is very similar to a paleo diet, although it allows some dairy and some other things, but it's probably most similar to a paleo diet. And we found that some of our patients did extremely well and went into remission when we were able to get off some of their immune-suppressing therapy, and others didn't really see much of a change. So when we explored a bit further and really looked at what people were eating, it was very clear that the amount of plants they were eating was really the distinguishing factor. And my friend Terry Walls, who's a physician in Iowa, wrote about this in her book, The Walls Protocol, for her own disease, which is MS, which she's very successfully treated, that when she went on a paleo diet, she didn't notice much difference. But when she started to really pay attention to the amounts of vegetables, and she recommends 6 to 9 servings of vegetables a day, that's when she was able to get out of her wheelchair and start riding 8 miles each way to work on her bicycle. It's a terrific read, The Walls Protocol. You know, I think that plant-based maybe more accurately defines it, and there's no question that the amount of plants you eat has a profound impact on the microbiome, which can then have a profound impact on some of these other disease states that we're trying to address.
Well, let's move then to this idea that the microbiota and the instructions that they're sending to our genome are affecting immune tolerance and therefore having a direct effect on the ongoing autoimmune diseases, which are becoming more and more common in the population. Can you explain immune tolerance and how the microbiome relates to that and instructs the immune system?
We know that germ-free mice can live in a very controlled environment, but we can't live germ-free. I mean, outside of, you know, some sort of artificial bubble that we would create. So we know that microbes are, in many ways, some we understand, some we don't, essential for life, essentially. And what we see is that if you think of it this way, when you're exposed to lots of microbes, your immune system gets a chance to sort of see, okay, well, this is something serious that I should respond to and mount a reaction and maybe get some white blood cells in the area to take care of things. And this, on the other hand, is something that I can ignore. This is not important. And that kind of signaling, it's like air traffic control, happens over and over again when we're young and when we're exposed to sufficient microbes, so that when we're older and we do come across something really bad, your immune system can mount an appropriate reaction. And similarly, when we're exposed to something fairly benign, like our own gut flora in the case of Crohn's, it doesn't overreact. Mm. And so immune tolerance really describes this state of adequate responsiveness to substances that should be eliciting an immune response. It describes an appropriate response, if you will, to these things. And it requires adequate exposure, and typically at a young age, for this to develop versus a situation where we're overreacting to things. We're overreacting to normal gut flora and creating ulceration and inflammation and Crohn's. We're overreacting to joint tissue and destroying it in the case of rheumatoid arthritis. So there is, a trade-off, because if you have too much tolerance, then it allows more pathogenic bacteria to actually get away with things. So there's a fine balance there between an immune system that's too tolerant and one that's overreacting.
Mm. And isn't it also true that there are certain bugs, I believe Klebsiella in the case of ankylosing spondylitis, which appear to inflame the immune system against the joints through molecular mimicry? In other words, a case of mistaken identity.
Yes, and you know, we're not sure because we see a lot of Klebsiella in people who have digestive conditions too, and we're not sure whether that is actually the culprit or whether that's sort of an innocent bystander, if you will, but a marker for something else that's going on. I know a lot of practitioners who treat the Klebsiella, unfortunately they treat it with antibiotics and that can lead to other problems, but yes, this concept of mimicry can be an issue. I wonder with the Klebsiella whether it's like Blastocystis hominis, which is another one of these organisms that's, we're not sure whether it's friend or foe. I see a lot of Blastocystis in people who have traveled a lot, in my patients who've been in the State Department or the Peace Corps. And I don't think it's a Blastocystis that's doing the damage, but I think it's a marker for microbial discord, because when you're seeing it in sufficient amounts for it to come up in a stool culture, it suggests that maybe things are a bit out of whack. But treating the Blastocystis, as some people do with metronidazole and so on, can lead to other problems. So I think there's a lot that we don't understand. We're getting a better sense of what a normal microbiome looks like, but there are a lot of things that we still don't understand in terms of some of these organisms that we see over or underrepresented.
I want to shift gears for a moment to David Whitlock and the ammonia-oxidizing bacteria. I think that we don't think about the microbiome of our skin, and I love the fact that you say in your book that the use of antiperspirant actually shifts your microbiome to give you more body odor. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, it really can. So there are typically two kinds of bacteria that we see in the underarms, and one, the Corynebacteria, which are typically more overrepresented in men because they are fat-eating bacteria, and men tend to have higher levels of lipids in the blood. So there are two. There's Corynebacteria, and then there's Staph. And as luck would have it, the staph tend to have very little smell, but they're more fragile. And the Corynebacteria are more odor-producing. And so many different types of antiperspirants can, particularly the aluminum salts and antiperspirants, can affect these bacteria, and they tend to have a greater impact on the staph. So they disproportionately decrease the amount of staph in the underarm area, which lead to an increase in the Corynebacterium, which are smellier. So when you use the antiperspirant, you're actually selectively killing off the odorless staph and selecting for the smellier Corynebacterium. And so the more of it you use, kind of the more you need. So you kind of develop this vicious cycle. And vaginal douching is another kind of bad idea there, because what you do is you kill off the native protective lactobacillus species in the vaginal vault, and you increase the risk of sexually transmitted diseases and urinary tract infections because you don't have those lactobacillus that are ready to produce acid and protect the vaginal environment. So we really have to think about the balance of things here and what we're doing with some of these personal care products and household products and the effect it has on our microbiome.
You made an interesting point about the changes that happen during pregnancy in the vaginal microbiome and how those might be protective, preventing infections in the amniotic fluid. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Yes, and I found this fascinating. I didn't know very much about this. I mean, the reproductive organs are kind of sister organs to the digestive organs, but we tend to sort of stay in our zone, if you will. So I was unaware of this before I started doing research for the book. But one of the most dramatic changes that happens during pregnancy is that the cells lining the vagina, the vaginal lining cells, ramp up production of glycogen, a carbohydrate. And that sends lactobacillus sort of into a feeding frenzy, because that's the main food for lactobacillus. So it increases the number of lactobacillus in the vagina. And again, lactobacillus convert lactose and other sugars into lactic acid, and that creates an acidic, unfriendly environment that helps to protect the growing fetus from potential invaders. So it's a great example of how you see an adaptation within the microbiome that really is for our survival and for the survival of our fetus. I mean, our microbes are primarily there to protect us. There's some there's some bad characters in there too, but most of them are there to protect us. And actually, something else that happens in pregnancy in the third trimester, levels of proteobacteria and actinobacteria increase, and they cause a rise in blood sugar, which you might think, well, that's not so good. You know, the blood sugar's rising. Maybe mom's getting pre-diabetic. But the rise in blood sugar and the weight gain in the breasts is actually, they're both there to make sure that there's adequate growth in breast milk for the baby. So it's an example of the microbes not just looking out for us, but looking out for our offspring. And there's a lot of confusion about that because people say, well, these bacterial species are causing prediabetes, but that spike in blood sugar is to make sure that there is food for babies specifically. And even more fascinating, you can transplant gut bacteria from a pregnant woman into a non-pregnant mouse, and you can produce these same changes in mice, like the increase in breast growth. So, you know, a lot of things we think are hormonal are really microbially mediated.
Excellent point. I guess context is extremely important, and our old kind of aim the bullet at the bug mentality needs to be reframed completely in this new era of the microbiome. Yeah. One last question about, since we're on pregnancy and talking about birth and how those bugs get into the baby, you made a point about how the actual mechanism of birth is sort of designed to get the baby to be smeared effectively with bugs on the way out.
Absolutely. During birth, as the baby's head crowns, it turns posteriorly to face the rectum, and that's to ideally position it as it passes through the birth canal to swallow a mouthful of microbes from that area in the perineum between the vagina and the rectum, which is chock full of microbes usually. And that swallowing, that simple act of swallowing a mouthful of microbes as we're born, is an incredibly important moment in our lives because it provides the founding species for our microbiome. And ideally that those founding species are lactobacillus and other healthy bacteria. We know that babies born by a C-section in the hospital tend to be colonized with hospital-acquired bacteria like Staphylococcus that are not so great and more associated with illness and infection. And we see that this effect carries on for years later. We see this ripple effect. So babies born via C-section have higher risks of asthma, allergies, type 1 diabetes, obesity, and other autoimmune diseases. And then if you add on to that babies who don't have the advantage of being breastfed and having some of the nutrients in breast milk that are important for nurturing the microbiome, these changes are even compounded by that.
I think that maybe we should rethink the practice of washing babies off right after birth.
Yes, in fact, there are some fascinating recommendations in this field of reseeding the microbiome in babies who are born via C-section, taking a swab and soaking it in the vaginal juices and then kind of wiping the baby down with it. It's a fantastic idea, but make sure you let your OBGYN team know what's going on before you start doing that.
Yeah, there might be a few nurses out there who didn't get the memo yet on that one.
Might call security on you.
Exactly. Well, I want to point out that you had a wonderful section in your book, sort of a how-to for a fecal microbiome transplant, and also some good precautions and suggestions for how to select a donor and what the process needs to look like. So we would love it if you took a moment to tell us about that.
Sure. So fecal microbiota transplant, essentially using stool from a healthy donor and introducing it into the body, usually through the rectum of somebody who's dealing with disease, has been really a breakthrough in the medical community in the last few years, particularly for Clostridium difficile infection, a kind of bacterial infection that can occur after antibiotic use. But it's not without its risk, because in addition to getting healthy microbes, you're also getting some not-so-healthy microbes. You're getting viruses. You're getting DNA material that you might not want, that might not be helpful. So it's important to undertake this judiciously and ideally to be treating a condition that we know is actually helpful and helped by a stool transplant. So things like C. diff infection, where we know that stool transplant is a gold standard for refractory C. diff. There's lots of great data for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. There's some good studies for irritable bowel syndrome. There's more and more literature on other autoimmune diseases like MS, and there's even some literature on Parkinson's. But the idea that, I think my microbiome is a bit off and I'm feeling fatigued and maybe I have some hair loss and some muscle aches, so I'm going to try a stool transplant. I really don't recommend it because, again, you can transmit some not so healthy things, some viruses and bacteria. Some of these things we can test for, but not all of them. There's cholera, cryptosporidiosis, E. coli, Giardia, hepatitis, Shigella, tapeworms, typhoid fever. There are a lot of things that can be spread through stool. And again, those are just the ones we know about. And there's many we don't yet know about that we can't test for. So it's important that you do that risk-benefit analysis and you make sure that the benefits outweigh the risks and that you're ideally doing this in the setting of a clinical trial where they can test the donor stool, they can look at your microbiome before, during, and after and make sure that you've had good repopulation and so on, as opposed to just deciding you're going to get a friend's stool and do it yourself at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we used to have this thing called non-A, non-B hepatitis that people got from transfusions. Turned out that was hepatitis C, but it didn't exist until we developed a test for it. It was just, one of those things that sometimes happens with transfusions.
Absolutely. No, that's a great example. And even though hepatitis C is not transmitted via stool, it's an example I use in my book as sort of buyer beware because we had no idea that it was out there. I mean, it's really just since the 1980s that we've been able to test for hepatitis C routinely with a blood supply. And I tell people there'll be a hepatitis, LMNOP, QRST, it's going to go on and on as we discover some of these new viruses and conditions.
Yes. Well, Dr. Chutkan, thank you so very much. I know that you are on a limited schedule, and I'll let you go before your secretary strangles me. But thank you again for your words of wisdom, and I highly recommend that people take a look at your book, The Microbiome Solution, available at an internet kiosk near you.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Unfortunately, due to time constraints in her schedule, Dr. Chutkan and I were not able to do a deep dive into some of the finer points of the concepts that we touched on. So I thought I'd take a moment and discuss a few ideas. First of all, this molecular mimicry concept that I brought up is related to the idea not that Klebsiella or Proteus are causing ankylosing spondylitis or rheumatoid arthritis per se, but that they resemble the body tissues that the immune system is attacking. And as such, they upregulate the immune system and increase the probability of a disease flare. They may also serve, as Dr. Chutkan pointed out, as indicator species that there is a dysbiosis present. And as we've already said, it is the signals from these bacteria that help keep the immune system in check and keep it from, going on the warpath inappropriately. Blooms of these bacteria may act as triggers for an existing smoldering autoimmune disease. And we also see sometimes that certain vegetables, such as the nightshade vegetables, can act as triggers for rheumatoid arthritis flares. And anyone with a diagnosis of RA should certainly go off tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, and peppers for a month, and then resume them and see if their symptoms shift. Generally, at this point, I think we can say that it is well established that pro-inflammatory microbiomes definitely appear to exist, and that manipulating them can reduce inflammation throughout the body. Dr. Chutkan makes a good point that seeking to eradicate Klebsiella or Proteus or blastocystis is not a good strategy. It's rather like taking a flamethrower to your lawn to get rid of dandelions. And it's especially bad because it reduces long-term bacterial variability, which is broadly characterized by resistance to disease and increased lifespan. And I want to emphasize that any antibiotic will reduce species variability in the microbiome, which is never a good thing. Low variability in the microbiome correlates with disease much more clearly than any particular species of microbiome flora does. Variability fosters resilience and across-the-board healing in the host, and that, my friend, is you. In her book, Dr. Shutkin discusses the specific known properties of commonly used probiotic bacteria. We do have a difference on opinion of dosing of probiotics. She uses much higher doses than I do. I have concerns that high doses of probiotics that are currently being prescribed by gastroenterologists may actually contribute to a condition called SIBO, which stands for small intestine bacterial overgrowth. SIBO is worse when people are on acid-blocking drugs like Prilosec. So it's important when you're taking acid-blocking drugs to worry about antibiotics and perhaps stop taking them for the duration. I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Dr. Robin Shutkin. And now for a few emails. By the way, you can send us an email at askdrdawn.com. Just hit the Contact Us button and fill in the information. Several of you inquired about a recent program on Terry Gross, a program I really quite enjoy myself, and I read the entire transcript. This program aired on August 18th, 2016, and was an interview with a man named Ed Young, a science writer, who has just published a book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Now, overall, I thought the article was very enjoyable, but I think that the problem here is that people are misconstruing what he said. He basically said yogurt isn't effective at helping people, that probiotics have orally taken have very narrow utility in treating infectious diarrhea. And then he went on to make a series of true statements, statements that people who are regular listeners to this program would probably agree with, and that would include me, the person who made those statements, which is that this is a complicated ecosystem and that we can't replace lost gut flora with probiotics. And I've been saying for years now that you have to change your diet and provide plenty of prebiotic, and that most of the probiotics that we take are sending chemical signals that are beneficial, but themselves do not establish a permanent foothold in the gut. And the main thing that Mr. Young is pointing out to is that when you take probiotics and then stop and a month later you culture the stool, you don't find the same strains of probiotics growing there. And indeed, that's true. The probiotics that you take orally kind of act like ground cover. And at the most, what they do is help restore and recreate a new kind of bacterial biofilm that will allow the bacteria that are tuned to your system to reestablish. There are, however, special cases. And you see, what he's setting up is this narrow thing. Well, we can't culture it from the colon, so it's not replacing the flora. That's really incorrect. It's doing a number of positive things. And there's plenty of data, for example, in allergies that show that certain bacteria, such as Lactobacillus rhamnosus, whether it's establishing in the gut or not, send a chemical signal to the immune system that reduces inflammation. And we see that reduction in allergy symptoms in placebo-controlled double-blind studies. I don't think even Mr. Young would dispute that. His concept that it's very complicated is absolutely accurate, but his statement that we don't have clinical utility for probiotics, I think, is misguided, and partially a response to the way that Terry asked her question, so I'm not entirely faulting him. Ultimately, there's good data that probiotics help restore the biofilm, that they send chemical signals that are anti-inflammatory, that they can pinch hit when you're taking antibiotics and prevent antibiotic-associated diarrhea, that certain probiotics can actually help prevent the very, very unpleasant and difficult-to-treat Clostridium difficile, both
Young and Terry were focused on the fecal transplant because, well, it's just such a outrageous topic. I can see why they spent a lot of time on it. But it's better to not need the fecal transplant in the first place. And that's what I suggest people are actually achieving when they take high-dose probiotics while they're on antibiotics and for a few weeks thereafter. Our next email is from Ted in Boulder Creek, California. Subject, undiagnosable muscle condition. Dear Dr. Don, I have a problem with tight muscles that are slowly getting worse and then got a lot worse this year. Back, glutes, thighs, psoas, muscles all stiffen, grip, and spasm a lot, especially when used. When not hurting, they're still tight. Have been to doctors in the last 6 months, and all tests, neurological and rheumatoid, are negative. Physical medicine's doctor's last comment was, I'm flummoxed. I'm taking baclofen, which helps, but also seems to prevent me from building strength up in my muscles, so I end up with muscle strains from minor exertion. Any idea would be much appreciated. Do I do consultations? Well, let me start with yes, Ted. You can just call my office, and I guess I can give out that number on my own podcast, 831-421-0197, and we'll set up a consultation for you. But before you do that, I had some suggestions. Here's a little checklist. First, make sure that you were actually given a test for creatinine kinase and a test for vitamin D. That's 25-OH vitamin D, please. The reasons I suggest those is that if a person has muscle pain after fairly minor exertion, you want to make sure that they don't have an elevated CK. Now, if those tests weren't done, I want you to go to your supplement cupboard and read all of the labels and make sure that you're not taking any red yeast rice. I also am assuming that you're not taking a statin to lower your cholesterol, because I think even a neurologist would have checked for that problem. But there is sometimes no blood test positivity, even though you are hurting your muscles with a statin. So in this circumstance, stopping your statin for, say, 2 or 3 weeks, given the nature of how statins work, is a pretty safe thing to do and will let you know whether or not the inflammation in your muscles is actually due to the statin. So I'd give that one a try if you're on that agent. And the reason I'm suggesting you look at your supplements is occasionally there will be red yeast rice in wellness supplements, and it's there for good reason. It does lower cholesterol, but it's not something that you want to take without taking a lot of CoQ10. And while we're on the subject in terms of other things to talk about, vitamin D deficiency can sometimes lead to a lot of problems with deep aching pain. And that could be mistaken for muscle soreness. So I just want to make sure that you aren't suffering from osteomalacia, which you can look up. But osteomalacia is where the bones are starting to soften. And in children, it leads to rickets. But in adults, it just leads to deep bone pain. So we want to check that one out as well. Some sort of inflammation certainly seems to be at work here. So do those things first, and while you're checking on those, magnesium is not a bad thing to try either. So taking a magnesium and potassium supplementation, you could just buy salt substitute, and I'm assuming you're not on any blood pressure medications, because if you are, you want to check with your doctor about mixing potassium with certain blood pressure agents that might need to be monitored. And extra magnesium doesn't really interact with much. So if you were to pick up, say, some magnesium taurate or magnesium glycinate, those are my two favorite types because they're well absorbed. Perhaps the taurate might have a little bit of a bias in this case because of its beneficial effect on muscles. And try to get up to 1,000 milligrams, maybe 3 daily divided doses. Too much magnesium will give you the runs, so you'll want to be careful with that. But that can often be really helpful with muscle pain. And hopefully they checked your thyroid. But if they did not, you definitely want to screen for thyroid problems because that can lead to this as well. Sure hope I've been able to help. Okay, our next one is a smoothie question, and I always love those. This is from David in Fairbanks. Love you, Dr. Dawn. I make 3 containers, 1.5 gallons, of smoothie with the following ingredients every Sunday. Flax seed, sesame seed, celery seed, turmeric, whey powder, yogurt, broccoli, red bell pepper, beets, mixed berries, cherry tomatoes. The drink is nice and red when I make them up, but after a few days they turn brownish. They don't taste or smell bad, and I usually throw in another beet to bring them back to red. Could I be harming myself by drinking a spoiled smoothie? Any other suggestions for ingredients that would also be appreciated? I also add extra virgin olive oil to my morning glass. Thank you. David, I think the major culprit here is oxidation. So as those compounds sit, they oxidize each other, and first of all, there's probably a layer of oxygen in your container, which doesn't help matters. And also, there's a lot of enzyme degradation going on. When I have a whole seed, like a sesame seed or a celery seed or a red bell pepper that's got intact cell walls, I've got a compound that has the flavonoids in a sort of sealed baggie, kind of like a Ziploc baggie. And it's protecting it from the air and protecting it from the other smells and odors in the environment. But once you run it through a blender, you've broken that open. And so, for example, the enzymes in the broccoli will go to work on the red bell pepper flavonoids, and the oxygen in the container is going to cause color changes. And so my point is that you're probably losing potency. I'm not so worried about rancidity with the flaxseed over that short a period of time. But I think that if you want to get the maximum benefit from your shake, what I would do would be to, instead of blending it all up at once, figure out your volumes and just put everything in a 1 gallon Ziploc that you're going to use for that day. And so just divvy it all up, keep the bell pepper whole, and the beets whole, the berries, the cherry tomatoes, the broccoli, you can just have the stems. You're going to need a strong blender. And then deliver the bell pepper and the beets at the last minute. Blend it all up and have that day's smoothie fresh. I don't know how old you are, but I would often have people put a little bit of protein, maybe some hemp protein or some whey protein, depending upon the state of your stomach and your ability to digest fat. I'll often put vitamin D oil in my smoothie, and there's lots of emulsified vitamin Ds that you can use. I like to add fish oil myself rather than the virgin olive oil, but if you're going to use fish oil again, you want to add that at the last minute, which is what you're doing with the olive oil. So I'm just having you throw in those vulnerable cell walls that you don't want to break open until the last moment to make sure that you get every bit of goodness from your supplement. And of course, I hope that you're keeping that flaxseed in the freezer. That's where it belongs, because you want your flaxseed, your olive oil, and your fish oil not to go rancid. That's extremely important. The only thing less healthy than slathering margarine on a spoon and eating it would be eating fish oil that's gone bad, and that is worse. So, hope I've helped, and boy, that's quite a recipe you came up with. I'm impressed.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.